from Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, an Israeli airstrike in Gaza draws condemnation from the U.S. and U.N. Lebanon's Sunni sheikhs call for a revolution. The U.S. sends 50 disease control specialists to West Africa to help fight Ebola. And a former U.S. Treasury Secretary calls for immediate action on climate change.
Heat creates environmental effects. The environmental effects then create more heat, and it goes back and forth, and that's how you can get the vicious cycles and catastrophes. So I think we have to act now.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The U.S. has condemned an Israeli strike in the southern Gaza town of Rafah, which killed at least 10 civilians who had sought shelter in a United Nations school. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki called it disgraceful and appalling. The attack also drew a strong rebuke from UN Chief Ban Ki-moon, who called it a moral outrage and a criminal act. The Israeli military later said it had targeted three suspected militants near the school and said it was reviewing the consequences of the strike. It is the third time in 10 days that a UN school has been the target of lethal explosions that have drawn international condemnation. Correspondent Scott Bob is in Yann Kounis and spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty.
Israel took exception to the area around Rafah. Why is that?
Well, it was a logical extension of their operation along the boundary. They started in the north, and those couple of neighborhoods there have since been sort of liberated, if you will. Israel has said people can return. And this part of central Gaza is still devastated, and they seem to have decided they've found what they're looking for here. And now the focus is on southern Gaza and Rafah and the area around that. This is part of their operation to destroy these tunnels. They found more than 30 so far and found just network and links, what they call an underground city. And this has surprised many of the analysts because it was far more extensive than they had anticipated.
Israel's taking a lot of criticism for explosions at another UN-operated school.
Yes, the Israelis say that there were mortars fired from nearby that school, and they are investigating the incident. No one has claimed responsibility or denied, but it's quite logical and possible that with the amount of firing going on in this densely populated enclave, that this would happen. And as long as there's hostilities, there are going to be civilian casualties because you have 1.8 million people living in one of the most densely populated parts of the world.
Scott, there are reports that the Army confirmed on Sunday it was withdrawing some troops from Gaza and redeploying others. Is the offensive coming to an end, or is it entering a new phase?
I would say what we've heard is some of the tanks and some of the ground troops have left the Gaza territory and repositioned it just outside. Entering a new phase, I think this is probably the ending of the second phase that we were seeing, which was the elimination of the tunnels. Whether there is a third phase or a new phase, which would be much more intense and much more costly, remains to be seen and depends upon the protagonists.
Is there any indication from either side, Hamas or Israel, of ending this conflict and agreeing to some sort of permanent ceasefire?
There is no indication that either side is prepared to agree to a formal ceasefire and the demands by the other side. In my view, a ceasefire does not really serve their interests. They're better served by maintaining this open, informal calm for calm. This way Israel can continue its operations as it sees fit, and Hamas can continue to its resistance as it sees fit and not have to declare a victory that nobody would believe in.
VOA correspondent Scott Bob speaking with us from Gaza. Militant Sunni clerics in Lebanon are agitating for a confrontation between Sunnis and Shia Muslims and are calling for an Iraq-style revolution, saying they sympathize with jihadists in Iraq and Syria. Jamie Detmer has details from Tripoli, Lebanon.
Clashes along Lebanon's border with Syria between the Lebanese army and Syrian insurgents, including jihadists, are growing. Over the weekend, 11 Lebanese soldiers and 40 gunmen were killed in the fighting. Despite the risk that the fighting will drag Lebanon fully into the mayhem of Syria's sectarian civil war, the country's militant Sunni sheikhs say they sympathise with the insurgents, including those fighting with al-Qaeda-affiliated groups. Sheikh Mohammed Gamil Nazir is a leading Sunni cleric in Lebanon's northern town of Tripoli, where local Sunnis have clashed frequently with the army and Shia Muslims. He says because of repression by the Shia-dominated government of Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and the tyranny of Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad, the Sunnis in those countries decided to rise up. He warns the same will happen soon in Lebanon. The Sheikh, a 46-year-old father of six, is nervous he's going to be arrested by Lebanese authorities for his outspokenness. During the interview with VOA, his supporters glance at a bank of closed-circuit television screens broadcasting images from outside his mosque, alert for a security raid. Last month, a prominent Salafist cleric was arrested in Tripoli. Lebanese security officials claim there are growing links between Sunni agitators and foreign jihadists who have been behind more than a dozen suicide bombings on Shia strongholds in Lebanon the past year. Asked whether he supports jihadist groups such as al-Qaeda affiliate Jabhat al-Nusra or the breakaway group the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant, which has been leading the Sunni insurgency in Iraq, the Sheikh chooses his words carefully. He says he disagrees with some of the extreme behaviour of the jihadists, but the Sunnis in Tripoli support the Islamic revolutions in Syria and Iraq, arguing they have managed to break the Shia crescent across the Mideast. Lebanese security forces are doing their best to contain violent sectarianism in Lebanon, and for weeks have been combating an estimated 3,000 Syrian rebels holed up along remote parts of the border near the Bekaa Valley town of Arsal. After the fierce weekend fighting in which 15 Lebanese soldiers were taken hostage, security officials say they are determined to win the battle in the next 48 hours, but insist they are not working in cooperation with Hezbollah, the militant Lebanese Shia movement whose fighters are battling Syrian rebels on the other side of the border. On Tripoli's main shopping streets, there is scepticism that the army and Hezbollah are not working together. Locals blame the domineering behaviour of Hezbollah for much of the growing anger of Sunnis. Assam, a store owner, says people are angry that the army arrests Sunni militants but does nothing against Hezbollah. There's no balance and Sunnis are being discriminated against, he argues. The army says it won't be deterred by threats of revolution. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Tripoli, Lebanon.
The United States says it is actively monitoring the situation in northern Iraq, where Sunni militants of the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL, Sunday, captured the formerly Kurdish-controlled town of Sinjar, the second town to fall to ISIL fighters in 2 days. They capitaled Zumar Saturday, both in Nineveh province. The U.S. State Department says it is gravely concerned about the fate of civilians in these areas, including vulnerable minority communities. It said it supports the Iraqi security forces and Kurdish Peshmerga fighters in their efforts to defend these areas against ISIL and is coordinating humanitarian efforts through Joint Operations Center in Erbil and Baghdad. RAND Corporation analyst Patrick Johnston says ISIL advances, which threaten oil fields and the Mosul Dam, were limited during most of July after its capture of the major cities of Mosul and Tikrit in June.
There's enough kind of capability and resistance on the part of the Iraqi security forces or the Kurdish Peshmerga that essentially ISIL has had to defend the areas that it had already taken, so probably focusing primarily on Mosul and Tikrit, and really needed to regroup and be able to set itself up to start this new offensive. But basically the strategy looks similar and I think gives us another kind of set of data points to confirm what we were already learning through the course of the June offensive, which was that targeting and attempting to take key towns, cities, and resource areas, whether they be water, oil, or other resources, is really at the center of the strategy. But these behaviors and actions relate to how it will ultimately look at Baghdad strategically and what its military objective is here in Iraq, and whether it's to control the areas that essentially it already controls now or it's heavily contesting, or whether it's going to continue to push both in Syria, Iraq, and potentially elsewhere.
Johnston believes his latest advance by ISIL reflects some change of approach.
It's different from some of the other displays of, and I think attempts to demonstrate by ISIS, their own capabilities. So what this does in terms of being able to deny areas electricity, potentially water, is to be able to control the delivery of tangible resources that are just relied upon for everyday functions in places. And if ISIL is able to deny effectively these resources and essentially, you know, service provision to its enemies, then either the fight will really escalate on the part of their enemies to try to recapture those areas so those resources and services are no longer denied to them, or it could have the impact of essentially breeding compliance with ISIL from actors who had previously been non-compliant.
We asked about the actions of the Kurdish forces.
The reporting that I have seen, you know, many of them suggest that the Kurdish militias have more or less surrendered on site when confronted by Islamic State fighters rather than fighting back and potentially losing a lot of forces. And that could either be because they recognize that the Islamic State now has more superior military capabilities to what the perception was earlier, or because they view it in their economic or political interest essentially to concede on these locations for some other objectives. So, again, a bit of a mystery, but I think it's an important set of developments that need to be closely watched in the next few weeks.
RAND Corporation analyst Patrick Johnston. Rescue workers in southern China are battling heavy rain as they try to reach survivors from Sunday's earthquake that killed nearly 400 people and injured 1,800 others. The magnitude 6.5 quake was the strongest in more than a decade in Yunnan province. Rebecca Valley has details from Hong Kong.
Rescue workers in Yunnan's Ludian County continued looking for survivors on Monday after the earthquake hit the largely rural area on Sunday. Officials say many people are still missing, but rescue operations are hindered by heavy rains and landslides, which have blocked access to some of the affected areas. The weather conditions forced emergency crews to carry equipment on foot and delayed the landing of army helicopters dispatched on Monday from the neighboring province of Sichuan. A policeman involved with the rescue efforts to clean up a road leading to the epicenter told China State Television CCTV big rocks fell on the road shortly after the earthquake. There was no way we could break through them with the machine, he says. We have to use explosives to open up a path for rescue services. The epicenter was in Ludian County, home to more than 250,000 people. China's Premier Li Keqiang arrived in the city of Jiaotong in Ludian County on Monday afternoon. He then walked on foot for 5 kilometers because rubble obstructed roads near the epicenter, Chinese media reported. Li instructed local authorities to provide adequate food, shelter, and medical treatment. Media reports throughout Monday highlighted a shortage of water, tents, as well as blood and medicines. Long Enshen is with the Sichuan University's Institute of Disaster Management and Reconstruction. He says that authorities dispatch people from the National Search and Rescue Team, and they will enter these areas using helicopters if the roads are blocked. But their effectiveness at the moment is still limited. In the initial state of the rescue work, the first and second day, he says, it is up to local authorities to organize relief. State news agency Xinhua says most of the homes in Ludian County were old and made of bricks. 12,000 of them collapsed, according to Xinhua. Long says that this is an area where the economy is still largely underdeveloped. The buildings and construction material are bad. That is why we're seeing such a high number of casualties, Long says. Local authorities are on high alert also for a quake lake formed after debris blocked a river near the epicenter. Chinese media report that 800 residents were evacuated from the area after water rose at a speed of 1 meter per hour. This was the most powerful earthquake to hit Yunnan in 14 years, according to Xinhua. 6 years ago, a devastating earthquake killed tens of thousands of people in neighboring Sichuan province. Rebecca Valley reporting for VOA News in Hong Kong.
Former U.S. Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin says it is wrong to see the issue of global warming as a trade-off between environmental protection and economic prosperity. The current Council on Foreign Relations co-chairman has written an article titled, Ignoring Climate Change Could Sink the U.S. Economy. We asked him how that could happen.
That was the title of the article, but I think the problem is much broader than that. I think climate change is a severe threat, not just to the United States, but to the entire global community. And I believe that if we, the global community, the United States, but the rest of the world as well, doesn't effectively address climate change, I think it will change life as on Earth as we know it. It will create, over some period of time, very high temperatures that in turn will raise sea levels, increase the frequency and severity of storms. It will reduce agricultural productivity and very severely in some parts of the world. There are countries that may be largely flooded out, and the list goes on and on and on.
And this is more than just a humanitarian issue. It's the money that it'll cost to cover all this.
I think it's worse. It's absolutely a humanitarian issue, but it's also an issue that goes much beyond the money. It's an issue really of how we live on Earth. So I'd call it an economic issue in the largest sense of the word.
What needs to be done to get a clearer picture of the expense of global warming?
I think it's very hard to judge the expense. There's been some very serious work done, and I was part of this, trying to make judgments about the most likely costs to the United States, not the globe, but the United States, over the course of the decades to come. And you come out with extremely large numbers, hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars over decades. But that's the most likely case. There are also extreme cases, that is to say, lower probability cases that, however, are realistic, that could be catastrophic. And I don't know how you put numbers on that other than to say that I think when all is said and done, it really will change the way we live.
What about businesses? Do they need to be apparent about what they are doing?
I think businesses should disclose, and actually I think should be required to disclose, the effect or the cost to society of the greenhouse gas emissions that they create. And I think that would create an incentive for businesses to more effectively try to reduce the emission of greenhouse gas. And also I think they should be required to disclose the ultimate effects that climate change could have on their properties and on their business. And I think all of that would be useful for investors in making the decisions. And I think it would give businesses an incentive to make climate change sensitive decisions.
It would prod the businesses and corporations out there maybe to change their ways in order to continue business.
Say that again, Susan.
It might prod businesses and companies to change their ways.
I think once businesses had to take account of the effects that climate that they were having on the environment and the effects that the environment were going to have on them, I think that it would almost surely cause businesses to change the way they function. I think that's exactly right.
This might take a while to get things changed around. What is your estimate on the world catching up with what needs to be done?
Well, I think that's a part of the problem here, a very serious part of the problem. We don't have time. The greenhouse gas emissions that go into the atmosphere every year, once they're in the atmosphere, decay over hundreds of years. So what that means is that what we do today will be with us for hundreds of years, for centuries. And it builds up, it accumulates, it builds up. And then as time goes on, the risks become greater and greater, what are called negative feedback loops. That is to say, the atmosphere creates, the greenhouse gas creates more heat. The heat creates environmental effects. The environmental effects then create more heat. And it goes back and forth. And that's how you can get to vicious cycles and catastrophe. So I think we have to act now. The problem is that there isn't the will to do that, the political will, either in the United States or anyplace else in the world. Now, having said that, this administration in the United States has begun to take some important measures, but far the greater part of what needs to be done lies ahead. And then it has to be not just the United States, it has to be the global community.
Robert Rubin, the former U.S. Treasury Secretary, currently the Council on Foreign Relations co-chairman. The United States is sending at least 50 disease control specialists to West Africa to help find, respond to, and stop the spread of the deadly Ebola virus, which has claimed more than 700 lives. VOA's Victor Beatty reports a second American healthcare worker who contracted the disease in Liberia is expected to return to the United States Tuesday.
The director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Tom Frieden, told U.S. broadcast interviewers Sunday that while the Ebola outbreak in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia is currently out of control, it can be contained.
What we're doing now at CDC is surging our response. We are going to put at least 50 public health experts in the three countries in the next 30 days, because actually we do know how to stop Ebola. It's old-fashioned, plain and simple public health. Find the patients, make sure they get treated, find their contacts, track them, educate people, do infection control in hospitals. You do those things, but you have to do them really well, and Ebola goes away.
Frieden says the impact of an Ebola outbreak on a society can be devastating.
It can destroy not just the confidence in healthcare, but have huge social and economic impacts on society. In parts of Africa where we've dealt with Ebola for years, we're now much better able to control it. We find the cases quickly, we stop them quickly, we prevent the practices that may allow it to spread. That's what we will eventually be able to do here. The sooner we do it, the fewer people will die from it.
He says a vaccine against Ebola is a long way away, and for now, the best way to contain it is to stop it at its source, namely West Africa. He cautions it will neither be quick nor easy. He expects the situation to worsen before it gets better. The World Health Organization says more than 700 people have died from the disease since it was first detected in Guinea in March. Frieden says Dr. Kent Brantley, who became infected while treating patients in Liberia and returned to the United States Saturday aboard a specially equipped private jet, is improving at Atlanta's Emory University Hospital. A second infected American, missionary Nancy Wrightbull, who also contracted the virus in Liberia, is expected to be transported to Emory on Tuesday. Friday, President Obama said U.S. officials are taking the situation very seriously.
As soon as there is an outbreak anywhere in the world of any disease that could have significant effects, the CDC is in communication with the World Health Organization and other multilateral agencies to try to make sure that we've got an appropriate response. This has been a more aggressive Ebola outbreak than we've seen in the past, but keep in mind that it is still affecting parts of three countries.
Mr. Obama says U.S. officials are taking appropriate precautions in screening African delegations in Washington for a three-day U.S.-Africa summit. Some 50 African heads of state are attending the summit. Two invited African leaders from Sierra Leone and Liberia canceled their participation due to the Ebola crisis. Friday, the World Health Organization announced a $100 million emergency plan in conjunction with the three affected countries that includes a strengthening of control and response measures. A WHO spokesman said some 600 specialists will be needed to carry it out. An estimated 2,400 volunteers from the International Red Cross Federation have been working in all three countries since the outbreak began. Meanwhile, Dubai-based Emirates became the first major international airline to suspend all flights to Guinea to prevent the spread of Ebola. It will continue flights to Dakar, Senegal, which borders Guinea. Several carriers and airports are screening passengers from the region for the illness. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
As Victor mentioned, a summit of U.S. President Barack Obama and some 50 African heads of state has kicked off in Washington. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry spoke to the Africa conference today.
Why does America care whether countries around the world, including African states, enforce the rule of law, reform their economies, and embrace pluralism? Very simple. We care because we believe that when people can trust their government and rely on its accountability and transparency, on justice, that society flourishes and is more prosperous and more stable than others. We believe that opportunity and prosperity are powerful antidotes to the violent urges of extremism and division. And we know that the gravest threats to the security of nations almost invariably come from countries where people and their governments are at odds, where they are divided.
U.S. Secretary of State Kerry, President Obama will address a U.S.-Africa business forum on Tuesday and take part in sessions focused on economic growth, regional security, and good governance on Wednesday. Well, thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. That's voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.